public servants. The good politician presented with a pair of somebody else's shoes will grow his feet.
The master.
In the days after he kissed hands with the king and accepted the premiership of Britain, the new prime minister had had dozens of meetings. He had met the chiefs of the defence staff, the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee, his new chancellor, the governor of the Bank of England, and the American ambassador. Oh, yes, and he had had his photograph taken by the government's official photographer. An image that would be on file and would be used all around the world. Olwyn Grimaldi, in his trademark cream suit and scarlet tie, seemed to stand a little awkwardly in front of the cream marble pillars of the Downing Street drawing room. His Welsh-Italian heritage was made flesh in a narrow skull with darkish skin and prominent bushy black eyebrows. He was smiling, but not happily. Over in the government whip's office in the House of Commons, they had loyally framed and mounted Olwyn Grimaldi.
"Clown," said the chief whip.
"It runs in the family," said his deputy.
A schedule of emergency spending cuts presented by the Chancellor earlier in the week was now in the hands of the whips. It would be part of their job to force these revised estimates through a House of Commons in which they had almost no majority. Since the election results had been declared, the chief whip had been reading his way through the memoirs and histories of the Callaghan Labour government of the late 1970s to see how it had been done then. He was not reassured. A litany of brutal threats, blatant bribery and outright deceit had only just kept that government going. Dying MPs had been stretchered into the House so they could be recorded through the I lobby. Road bridges, power stations and pipelines had been promised to buy off wavering MPs. And in the end, of course, the whole rickety structure had crashed down anyway, leaving Margaret Thatcher to stride through the wreckage to her first devastating victory. The chief whip had been reciting some of this ancient history to his deputy.
"Someone wrote a play about us, you know, back in the early 2010s. It was on at the National Theatre. The whips. It made us out to be heroes, despite everything."
"Well, that's something. It's a bloody impossible job, but at least you get a bit of recognition."
"Trouble is, back then the whips were saving big people. Callaghan, Healy, Shirley Williams, even Tony Benn. We've got a cabinet of midgets by comparison. Think of them. They're all 30-something straight out of think tanks, or they've worked as researchers or whatever. No real jobs, no real grasp of the country around them."
It was a familiar moan, but the deputy chief whip felt it was spot on.
"And the troubles we're facing now are just as bad as they were in the 1970s. Maybe worse. There's the deficit. The pound weak as fuck. Now we're out of the EU, the Americans are calling the shots more than ever. And the country's just grumpy. Even the weather's against us. The floods, the coastal battering, the summer droughts. How long before extreme weather produces extreme politics? At least there's one thing we don't have to worry about so much right now. The party's more united than it used to be. The Tories and the Lib Dems are knackered after all those years of power and feuding. We'll get our majorities, most of the time. Grimaldi's new. The boys and girls will give him a chance."
"I'm not so sure." The chief whip gestured at the photograph. "There's something brittle, something thin about him. That ridiculous suit. That scared-looking smirk. You know how things are. We build them up and then we knock them down, cut them off at the knees. I don't think our great leader has a very long career ahead of him."
"Well, he has to stand up to the Yanks. That's the first thing.
They want this new defence, trade and intelligence agreement. If Grimaldi told them to get stuffed, the party would back him every inch of the way.
If... Oh, I know. He's a clown, basically,
but we have to give him a chance.
The same photograph of Ulwin Grimaldi was on prominent display at 35 Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré in Paris, the palatial 18th-century home of Napoleon's sister Pauline, otherwise known as the Princess Borghese. Grabbed from the Bonapartes by the Duke of Wellington, for more than two centuries it had been the British Embassy. Its yellow room, its blue room, and its splendid red room with Pauline Borghese's grand golden bed retained a sense of Napoleonic splendour tucked away and under the control of the old enemy, in the heart of Paris. The current ambassador, Sir Anthony Bevins, enjoyed everything about the posting that his predecessors had loved so much. The view overlooking the little private lawn, the wonderful parties, the invitations to the opera, and the many splendid restaurants nearby. But Sir Anthony was a worried man. There was a cloud in the sky, growing steadily more menacing, that had not confronted previous ambassadors. Now that Britain had left the EU, the British rated less here. At the Élysée Palace down the road, questions had been asked about whether such a modest little nation, no longer in the Union, really needed quite such a splendid embassy.
"It's all a little 1945, don't you think, Ambassador?"
the French President's press secretary had muttered to Bevins at the cocktail party he'd thrown to celebrate the King's birthday.
"All this grandeur britannique."
The Brazilians and the South Koreans were both looking for new accommodation. That wouldn't have worried Sir Anthony, had not similar noises been coming from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in London, itself housed in a grand enough building. It couldn't be denied that the Paris embassy was exceedingly expensive. Now that so much of Britain's relations with Europe were conducted via Brussels, was it really a good investment any more? The British newspapers had withdrawn from Paris. The BBC had retreated too. The embassy felt embattled. During his last visit to London, Bevins had deflected the suggestion of downsizing with an airy wave at the gigantic staircases, huge paintings, and echoing corridors of the FCO. Something very similar, he pointed out, could be said about that place. But very soon, he'd need a more serious response. These days, the real work was done by Number 10 and the Secret Services. The Grimaldi government was pushing through new cuts all round. The permanent secretary had summoned him back to London for a face-to-face. It was all, undoubtedly, ominous. So Sir Anthony, uneasily aware that he needed all the friends he could get, had been delighted when the former Prime Minister, whose friends called him, perhaps partly in jest, simply the Master, had said he needed a discreet base where he would not be bothered or spotted. He had asked to use the embassy, unofficially, of course. Since the Master and his old coterie often stayed at the Borghese Palace when they were passing through Paris, nothing could be easier. On a brisk March morning, then, the Master stood, almost like an 18th-century monarch, greeting his loyal lieges. There was Sir Leslie Kahn, beautifully dressed in a blue alpaca coat. With his 19th-century beard, the Master thought, he suited Paris. There was Alex Brodie, the rumpled, rather grey-looking former Chancellor, foul-mouthed Murdoch White, down from his island, grumbling about his complicated journey. And Sally Johnson, the former party chair. In the old days, she'd been dressed by Marks and Spencers. Today, it was Givenchy. Sir Anthony ushered them in, offered coffee and cakes, brought him from Fauchon, had a few words with the Master about the threat to the embassy, and was encouraged by his exclamation of shock, and left them to it, as he was expected to do. The Master, far from being diminished by his long years out of power, seemed fitter than ever, lean, tanned, with a full head of grey hair, and brimming with energy and confidence. All that money had lacquered him like a honeyed gloss. He was wearing jeans. Worse still, they had been freshly ironed.
"Guys,
Hey, thanks for coming. You've all got a bed made up here, and I've booked us a table at the Bristol this evening. Now then, London guys. We have half a dozen people in place, all of them good, all of them new. I'm afraid the government itself is despised. They're all kids. They mean well, but no intelligent observer thinks they're up to it. Alwyn, well, you probably remember Alwyn from his days as a researcher in Number 10. Nice kid back then, but he still is. Thanks to you, you in particular, Murdoch, and you, Leslie, we have a couple of excellent contenders. Guys, our problem is that it's still too early for them. We have to hothouse them. The former leader palpated his fingers as if he were trying to cast a spell. And force their political growth so they'll be ready. Sally Johnson, always famous for her ability to prick the master's exuberant optimism, swallowed the last of an immaculate vanilla macaroon, licked her lips like a cat, and interrupted. Small problem. I mean, literally, a small problem. He's only just over 5 feet high. But there's already, as it were, a Prime Minister. As much as it may amaze us all here, the man won an election. The master appeared not to have heard her. He got gently to his feet and walked to the window. He looked out at a cluttered private courtyard, making it seem as if he were gazing at a glorious future. Being in Paris helped, but he was good at that kind of thing. We are back. I am back. That is the point, and we must never lose sight of it. When we choose to bring Alwyn's splendid service to his country to a suitable conclusion, he will be ready to go. And we will be ready. And at least one of our young protégés will be ready. I am relying on you to make sure of that. Take courage and look around. There is more real political talent in this room than in the whole of Westminster. And then he turned tetchily on Sally. I can't be expected to think of everything myself. Leslie Kahn had been playing with a small cigar. He had pulled it out of his breast pocket, taken off the cellophane, spent quite a long time biting off one end, and was now rolling it between his fingers and sniffing it. Smoking was strictly forbidden in the embassy, as it was in every public building across Europe, and the others were fascinated by what he would do next. Leslie had no intention of lighting the thing, however. It was just a way of getting attention before he spoke. A little trick. A tiny little trick. Master, colleagues, we must not lose sight of the bigger picture. None of us are here to further our own careers. We all know that politics without principle and a clear line forward is an empty game. This is about the future of Britain. After all our sterling work back in the 1980s and 1990s, Britain is again alone, cut adrift from the main currents of the modern world. We could have given up. We have villas on the Côte d'Azur and comfortable yachts, or we have good friends who have those things. But we have all chosen the harder path. So I repeat, let us not lose sight of the bigger picture. The master, listening intently, nevertheless felt it was time for him to pick up the thought. He smoothed his upper lip as if there were a moustache on it, and patted Sir Leslie on the sleeve. The bigger picture. The harder path. Exactly, Leslie. I think we all feel a calling. I know I do. How often have I looked upwards, enjoying a meal or a holiday, and said, Lord, take this cup away from me. Hey, come on, big man, bother somebody else. But will he listen? Alex Brody was covertly rolling his eyes and making little revolving gestures against his temple with his forefinger. The faintest smile hovered above Sir Leslie Kahn's beard. The rest of them,
kept their faces straight. I know that, perhaps satirically, people call me the master. They would be better to call me the servant. Are we not all servants, after all? Even you impious hoodlums sniggering behind your hands. The servants, at least, of your country and your own political destinies. But, guys, the Americans, I'm afraid, have muffed it, rather. I said as much to Hillary recently. By linking the new World Bank loan to a fresh agreement on military and intelligence cooperation, they have contrived to look like the bullies of Britain rather than our natural and closest allies. Ever the optimist, I always thought that Alwyn Grimaldi and the rest of the socialist kindergarten would fold. But it looks as if they won't. So we have to ensure that our people start to get things back on track. First with the Americans, and then with our friends in Europe. If not, our host's understandable anxiety about his pleasant surroundings here would be the least of it. The master shook his head. The ambassador is an awful old fool, guys, I'm afraid. If I had my way, I'd close this place down myself. He is the old Britain we were trying to get away from. It's useful, of course, that he's such an old softy. Now, as to the Americans and all that, we have to choose our time well. Grimaldi's government can't survive many months with such a tiny majority, but we need to inherit a government that's worth inheriting. In the short term, we need to prop it up. Leslie, Alex, use your excellent contacts with the Liberals and the pro-European Tory rump to make sure things don't collapse too quickly. We'll get our people into junior jobs. Then we'll need a resignation or two. Then the PM himself. Lots to do! He rubbed his hands together. Lots to do! But before that, the former cabinet colleagues enjoyed a leisurely day in Paris. They strolled in the Tuileries, tolerating the odd stare from British tourists. The master took Murdoch White, who had a good collection of Scottish paintings, into the Orangery to see Monet's Nymphea. The only good paintings of time actually passing in the world. The master was full of surprises. Leslie Kahn, for his part, had always wanted to bed Sally Johnson. Today, thinking of her expensive underwear and her exquisite little room at the embassy, she acquiesced with a cheerful smile. Later, they all went for supper at the Bristol. They ate sea urchins from cold Norwegian waters and the hind quarters of hares from the Pyrenees. Life, even in 2019, even for exiled British leaders, could occasionally be tolerable. Back at 35 Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré, the ambassador was sitting at his ornate desk in his ornate room wearing a pair of utilitarian plastic headphones. He was pausing, then playing again a recording on his private laptop. Sir Anthony Bevin smiled his thin smile. Perhaps, after all, there was a way of demonstrating to those in power that the British Embassy in Paris remained a useful asset. Awful old fool, though I may be.